Blog Talk Radio.
Koda, Mojuba, Asheda, Mojuba, Alua, Mi, Apolabi, Pega, Mojuba, Araba, Mi, Adesanya, Awuyade, Mojuba, Ogute, Compound, Ode, Remo, Mojuba, Baba, Mojuba, Yeye, Mojuba, Egun, to all the God children, Mojuba, Egun, to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba, Egungun, to all the chiefs, Mojuba, Egungun, to all the Awos, Mojuba, Egungun, to all those that are listening, who are tuned in. We give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe,
Ashe,
Ashe. Welcome to Sign of the Times, everyone. This is Queen Tahira. Sign of the Times is brought to you by New Power Radio Network, Manhood, Race, and Culture, AAES, and Unity Design. You can find Manhood, Race, and Culture on Facebook as well as the World Wide Web at manhoodraceculture.com. Also, Unity is spelled UNITEE. Please look for Arlie Gordon on Facebook as well as the World Wide Web at unitydesign.com. And again, Unity is spelled UNITEE. And we also can't forget our newest sponsor, AAES, the All African Empowerment Society, headed up by my beloved brother, Laquay Jewel. Please look for Laquay on Facebook as Laquay Jewel, J-U-E-L, or check out AAES on the World Wide Web at aaesociety.net. And so tonight we're having a listen and learn session because we are preparing for a national or at least a Midwest convention coming up next week. We need to get some work done and some I's dotted and some T's crossed, y'all. So I'm a woman of many hats, and tonight we're going to have a listen-in session that deals with mass incarceration. It deals with alternatives to mass incarceration, as well as some of the issues that we may not even have thought about discussing before, but we certainly will be discussing in the near future. I also want to ask that you all please support Imam Hassan of the Free Ohio Movement, as he is in the midst of an unfair struggle with the Ohio, with OST there in Columbus. And so we'll get into that a little bit later as we get more details. But please just keep Imam Sadiq Hassan in your thoughts and prayers as we proceed. There also is a hunger strike there at the Ohio State Penitentiary, and we want to send our brothers as much positive energy as they can. It's one thing to have people pay their debt to society by having to be confined and do the time, but, you know, when you get into extenuating circumstances that create the opportunity for those who wish to continue to oppress us to continue to do it with multiple tools at their disposal, we've got to start to look at that as a community and try to resolve it. There are always alternatives to placing someone behind bars, and I'm not sure how many of those are actually continuing to be explored, but as long as the people care enough to speak truth to power, we definitely can begin to address it. So, again, please keep the Free Ohio Movement, the Free Alabama Movement, New Jersey, California, Texas, Wisconsin. There are many, many battles being fought on behalf of those who are confined. So we wish our brothers and sisters in the fight the best. We are working on a unified front across the nation, and the best is yet to come. And so, you know, we need to look out for those who are immediately at the mercy of the state. And unfortunately, you know, confined citizens are our first ones that are often targeted. So, we'll talk a little bit more next week about the conference, and it's happening in Columbus, Ohio from August the 26th to the 28th, and it's called Bend the Bars. So if you go on Google, if you go on Facebook, and you look up Bend the Bars, it will come up. You can register and check out the agenda and check out the workshops and things like that and see where you think you might be able to fit in. So everybody has a role to play in this, and we're asking you to humbly play your part in solution finding. So tonight we are listening to Ruth Wilson Gilmore, and it's a critique of mass incarceration. And then we're going to check out a couple of brief pieces dealing with alternatives to mass incarceration. It's titled Don't Reform Prison, Abolish Them, and the Economy of Mass Incarceration. And again, our guest teacher tonight is Ruth Wilson Gilmore. So if you know Ms. Gilmore, tell her we said hi here at Sign of the Times, and we love her work. So thank you, everybody. Check out the broadcast. Check out the listening session. And we will see you on Tuesday with Dr. James Jones here on Sign of the Times. We love y'all.
one of the printed programs, it says something really grand, like I co-founded Critical Resistance with Angela Y. Davis. Angela and I were two of about 30 people who together started that abolitionist organization. So it wasn't just the two of us, and although I'm always pleased for my name to be linked with the great Angela Y. Davis's, there were a lot of other people involved. If I had the time, I would list them. All right, I am an abolitionist. Abolition. Abolition is a plot against racial capitalism, which is all capitalism, not just some of it. It is a plot in a narrative sense. It is a plot in which the arc of change is always going resolutely toward freedom. It is a plot in a geographic sense. It is a plot in which we aim to make all space, not just some space, free in two senses. Free in the sense that it cannot be alienated, which is to say sold by anybody to anybody, and free in the sense of non-exclusive. There is no boundary or border that would keep somebody in or keep somebody out. That is abolition. That's the plot. That's my plot. It is an internationalist impulse that is part of what many of us call the black radical tradition, which is open for all. It's not just for black people. I'm going to talk about the criminals, because your innocence will not save you, as Nancy's remarks should have indicated by now. And I will talk about a couple of actions that have happened in California recently to give meat to my observation. In the California state prisons, recently, over the last couple of years, at the same time that North Africa and West Asia were exploding into well-documented in the mainstream media in the USA uprisings, there was an uprising that was organized as a hunger strike. This uprising was organized by prisoners who are in indefinite detention inside prison. So they're already convicted, they're doing time, and then they're doing time indefinitely inside the prison. They're in a prison in the prison. They're in what's called the security housing unit, which some of you might know about. It's a form of imprisonment that was innovated in the former West Germany, where in the absence of a death penalty, the forces of both state and corrections in West Germany were trying to figure out how to wipe out the Red Brigade. They had caught the Red Brigade, they had tried and convicted those people, but they couldn't execute them because they didn't have a death penalty. And the purpose of the SHU was to induce death in the people locked in it. And that is what it does. It makes people crazy. Everybody knows that it is a violation of human rights to keep anybody in solitary confinement for more than 15 days. And there are people who have been in the security housing unit in California for 15 and more years. And they can never get out. There's one man I know I've talked to many times who's been in the hole since 1973. The prisoners in the security housing unit are divided by race and region, and this is part of the deliberate plan by the California Department of Corrections, to keep people apart inside. The department innovated this process not just as a reflection of the divisions outside, even though we know that the U.S. is more segregated by race and class now than it was in 1960, they innovated this kind of division inside to break apart radical prisoner organizing that was the hallmark of prisons in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, as many of you might know, either from memory or from study. And in dividing the prisoners into these groupings by race and region, they effectively established prison gangs inside and then fomented warfare between them. They did this, the Department of Corrections, in order to get the prisoners' minds off the oppressor, the guards, and onto each other. That plus television worked. It worked very well. So the prisoners have been in the hole now for decades and decades and decades. They put forward demands in that their hunger strike was the force behind, asking for rather simple, straightforward things. They asked for a way to get out of indefinite detention without doing one of three things, which are the only way to get out now. You snitch, you parole, or you die. Right? They said, we don't want to snitch. Many of us will never parole. We're doing life. And we don't want to die in the hole. So give us a way to get out. They asked for adequate nutrition because as the prison system has grown and grown, they've figured out ways to squeeze, and it's totally public. It's totally public. Write that down. Figure out ways to squeeze resources out of the bodies of prisoners so that the resources that circulate through the prison will circulate mostly in the form of wages to both guard and non-guard staff and to pay the utilities that keep those cities running, because the prison is a city. And the prisoners asked for some other things as well. The Department of Corrections cavalierly refused to meet the prisoners' demands and offered a counterproposal that was insulting at best. However, tens of thousands of prisoners throughout the California state system and some in systems beyond California joined the hunger strike in solidarity with those in the security housing unit. When the Department of Corrections response came out, the department, of course, then hunkered down for some kind of violent uprising. That's not what happened, not surprisingly. The prisoners who are in solitary confinement, who actually spend 23 hours a day locked in their cells, who sometimes get to go 1 hour a day and walk up and down in a little pen that you wouldn't even put your dog into if you had a dog to put in a pen, people who have never seen the horizon in all the years that they've been locked up, those people put together a new set of demands. And their new demands, instead of going vertically up to their keepers, were sent out horizontally to everybody else locked up in all the communities that they came from. And they sent out demands horizontally to end the hostilities between the races. This is huge. It's huge because the people who have been locked inside, who have in one way or another, wittingly or not, participated in the race and ethnic war that the department fomented in order to secure itself as a department, have now seen and refused to be participants in that anymore and have sent word out to the communities they come from to do the same kind of thing. This is a very frightening thing in the United States of America, where our division is always very important for the security of racial capitalism and the contemporary neoliberal state. So I call that to your attention. The second case I want to give describe to you very briefly are gang injunction zones. And these are places that are outside of prisons and jails. They're in communities. It is a form of spatial control that is enacted through civil law, not criminal law. Civil law. And what civil law does is to divide up the spaces of the communities, of the cities and municipalities and neighborhoods, where people who have been convicted of certain crimes, some of their associates and some of their associates' associates, are forbidden to go. Now, many people imagine that what gang injunctions do is keep, you know, low-income, mostly male, persons of color out of, say, gentrified areas. That's not what it does. Divides up people and separates people from their communities, from their neighborhoods, from their streets, from their households, from their families. That's what gang injunctions do. So people have been organizing all over the United States to fight against gang injunctions, and I don't have time to give you the history of gang injunctions, but it goes pretty much hand in hand with the history of the security housing unit that I laid out for you in the case of the California Department of Corrections. Now, as I think I said earlier, and if I didn't, I should have said, and I'll say again, innocence doesn't save anybody. So making an argument that one is not a criminal, and therefore we know who the criminals are, is not going to save one single person, none of the people we advocate for, and certainly not ourselves. Because if an injury to one is an injury to all, that means, among other things, that the criminalization of one is the criminalization of all, and we should take that seriously. I see that my good friend Saad Ahmed is here, and he is going to be speaking this afternoon, and he might bring up in greater detail what I will describe to you very briefly. The New York City Terrorism Interdiction Unit, not unlike the Boston one that Nancy was describing, that unit, somebody inside that unit, leaked to us on the outside a one-day brief from that unit to the chief of police, to Ray Kelly. On that one-day brief, one single day, 2008, right, Fon? Like April something, 2008. It's started with, in the wake of the acquittal of several police officers in the murder of Sean Bell, the police are to watch a certain independent black mosque. Then it goes through critical resistance, Desi's Rising Up moving, the Gina 6, which is in Louisiana. It mentions by name a number of people in critical resistance and in other organizations. It goes on for 2.5 pages. And toward the end, the target is Muslim student organizations in the City University of New York, and particularly a vacation that a group of students took that one of the spies went along on, where they went upstate in New York, went rafting, prayed, and talked about religion. That's one day's report. So the connection between all of us and the impossibility of making a bright line between people who have been convicted of crimes and those who haven't should be apparent. Civil death stalks the land. Human rights might be the response to civil death, as Malcolm X argued, but that answer has got to be aspirational civil human rights in the form of abolition, not the scientific sort of human rights that is being practiced today as though there were a technical response to every problem. I.L. Weissman calls the kind of human rights that are being practiced today that condone 29 people being killed by a drone, but not 31, lawfare. And we cannot succumb to lawfare in order to try to reach our goals. Innocence is no defense. Abolition is the only offense against the human sacrifice that brought us here together today. Thank you. The argument I'm going to make tonight with a lot of examples is that while CR did not invent anti-prison activism, nor even coin a term we've made very popular, the prison industrial complex, what we have done is push a radical agenda as well as develop organizations on the ground in order to clear space for non-reformist reform. So that's my argument. And the argument isn't in order for everybody to say at the end of the day, oh, without critical resistance as an organization present in every city, this work isn't possible. Quite the contrary. It's really the thinking and visioning that comes out of the abolitionist theory and practice that makes possible all kinds of work done by all kinds of people who might not, in many cases, do not call themselves or think of themselves as abolitionists, people who are doing non-reformist reform, which is the without which nothing of abolition. So what is abolition? In the anti-prison world, we have tried hard to find ways to say what we mean that can't be recuperated, can't be displaced or turned back or turned into non-reformist reform. In other words, what we try to do is describe the problem and our solutions to it in such a way that prison cannot be thought as a normal future condition for any society, but rather that the future social order will be in part organized by the absence of prison as all-purpose solutions to social problems. Right? So we're thinking about the absence, but in order to think about the absence, obviously we have to think about a lot of presence, right? Because it's not just a void. We are dialectical, if nothing else. Abolition works simultaneously at all scales of analysis, whether you're speaking in generalities about things like criminalization or globalization or racism, or speaking very specifically, this happened to somebody the other day because he or she was driving while immigrant or black or some combination of those or with a felony and so forth. So abolition works simultaneously at all scales of analysis and action. Thus, as a group of us discussed earlier this afternoon, criminalization, a big general word that refers to an enormous and daunting process, occurs through the enactment of little things, right? So laws, but then how the laws are actually applied, to whom and to what end.
Campaigns are made, as everybody here knows, from the selection of specific things, patterns, driving while black, patterns, death penalty, patterns, who is in prison and for what reason, or school segregation, or prisoner disfranchisement, or immigrant targeting, or domestic violence, and generalized to a cause for one or many. So first, then, I want to make a kind of big argument, or really a polemic, to emphasize what's at stake, and why I call myself a theory Puritan and method slut. Then I'm going to talk about how the abstractions and generalities have been put into operation with some very concrete examples with pictures to make it exciting. All right, so now I'm going to quote one of my favorite revolutionaries of all time, who said in about 1960, "I do not propose to be impartial. Any public lecturer on politics who says he is impartial is either an idiot or a traitor." Anybody know who said that? C.L.R. James. There is anti-racist movement against mass incarceration everywhere I go. And the challenge for all of us is to work hard, and even harder than that, so that already existing motion coalesces and heads in a purposeful direction. The difference between abolition and reform is purpose, not means. So a lot of abolition work can be carried out using some of the techniques and strategies of reform, but with a different purpose, so that the end will be different. The difference, abolition is a practice of asking questions that lead away from the same old answers, even if there's nothing new under the abolitionist sun. Not so long ago, I watched the Freedom Riders documentary. Did any of you see it? It came out last May, I guess. It's fantastic. One thing it shows very powerfully is the relative autonomy of the movement from the leaders, right, the official leaders, and yet shows the relationship of leadership of various types. And remember, leadership is always a function of followership. Right? So it shows the relationship of leadership to movement dynamics. So after Klan-organized mobs fractured the original Freedom Riders' strength and stamina by attacking them in Birmingham, sanctioned, as you know, by Sheriff Bull Connor, and then in Montgomery, site of the 1955 bus boycott, the newly constituted Sojourners headed to Jackson. Mississippi Governor Ross Barnett assured the Magnolia State Klan that mob action was not needed because he promised he would, quote, use the law to stop these outside agitators. The riders, who by then were not a single busload from D.C., but converging from everywhere around the country, thanks to the leadership modeled by Fisk students, Diane Nash and others, were sent to Parchman Farm, the notorious prison plantation in Mississippi, by the hundreds. While neither the Freedom Riders nor the radical civil rights movement was destroyed by this intervention, the typical post-war method of stifling radical activity took shape then and there, and in the wake of endless human sacrifice of the 20th century, achieved particular form. You following me? Isolate, individualize, criminalize. Right? So we get a practice put into place. The Freedom Riders and much of the civil rights movement targeted, of all things, infrastructure for desegregation, right? They targeted schools, they targeted highways, they targeted mass transportation. Their focus on these large-scale things that have everything to do with how we live in the landscape, sought to put into the landscape, the land around us, something new. The capacity for us to determine for ourselves protections from calamity and opportunities for advancement that would not be fettered, which is to say, enchained by racist hierarchy. This focus was, I believe, inspired by a long-term vision to shift the foundations of the struggle for freedom. to shift it completely, so that freedom wouldn't turn into something that it actually seems to be in common sense today in the United States, that freedom is somehow simply the absence of having cuffs, handcuffs on your wrists, or the absence of being in a cage. While infrastructure aids, helps efficiencies of all kinds. So the infrastructure of UIC makes educating massive numbers of people more efficient than if education were scattered all over the city and we couldn't come to a central place and have the lights and the camera and the action in order to learn. So it aids efficiency of various kinds, but also infrastructure slows things down. Right? It slows things down because how we do what we do becomes tied to particular methods rather than others. The long-term effect of this, so imagine how tied we all are to cell phones today, right? It makes life really efficient, and yet. The long-term effect of this can stifle innovation, but it can also be productive of solidarity. We can be more have more solidarity because we can send out mass texts. But also, thinking about other ways to reach out and connect might be stifled. And solidarity, of course, is its own kind of innovation that then shifts how we do what we do. The challenge for us is to figure out when a bridge is a bridge, when a bridge is a roof, when a bridge is a means for connection and communication, when it is a place to play soccer, when it is a zone for exclusion. So it isn't as though objectively infrastructure is good or bad, is life enhancing or life shortening, but rather what use we make of it is what matters. And certainly the use that's made of the University of Illinois at Chicago is, in so many ways, life-enhancing, while some schools, perhaps one down the street, is going in the other direction. So here's where abolition comes in. In turning against what is, the goal is not simply to erase it, to obliterate it, to smash it, although we often use that language, smash the PIC, tear down the PIC, destroy the PIC. But what we want to do is make something new out of it. So we don't want to make it more comfortable or make it more pretty or make it more ecologically appropriate for the places where prisons are. But rather, we want to take all of the resources that go into making mass incarceration the everyday normal condition of existence and category of analysis that it is, and turn all that stuff into something else. So the easiest example to think of destroying something in order to make something else we can take from nature, and that is to say a seed becomes a plant, right? So going, coming, right? Metamorphosis is one way to think about this dialectical process, this process of negation, shall we say. Another example would be this. Recently, a few years ago, there was a case in a place in California, and this has happened in many states other than California, in addition to California, where a prison was being taken offline, and suddenly there was this building made of concrete and steel that sat on the edge of a town, and the question was what was going to happen to it. Needless to say, the city fathers and mothers and others thought that what they should do is find somebody who wanted to rent the prison space. Fortunately for activists in the community, it wasn't up to the city what would happen with the space because it belonged to the state of California. So what we did in order to do the work of raising abolitionist sensibility in a community that was mostly peopled by long-distance migrants with and without documents, as well as waged and wage-less African-Americans, second and third generation migrants from the U.S. South, was to have a charrette, have a series of meetings where people would come and sit down with architects and planners, and we'd use the plan of the prison to talk about what we could do with that place, with that building, with those resources, to turn it into something the community wanted and needed. Now, in some cases, most notably in Louisiana, where parents and others successfully converted a juvenile detention center to a community college branch, in the case of California, we did not win the battle to convert that place, but what we did achieve was solidarity in the struggle of doing this visioning work together, solidarity with people who were themselves trying to organize themselves to keep away ICE, right, to keep from being deported, to keep away police looking to bust somebody on outstanding warrants, to keep away all of the various threats to them that for them in their everyday lives signified life in the prison industrial complex. Right, so we did that political work, came out of that project. We seriously wanted the building. We didn't get it, but we got other things. So here's where abolition comes in again. It's turning something, instead of obliterating, turning something into something new. So it's not surprising to me, and yet I ask myself the question all the time, why are so many people stuck in the rut of thinking there's no way out of this mess, and that all we can try to advocate on behalf, all we can try to do is advocate on behalf of the relatively more innocent of those millions and millions and millions who have been caught up in the PIC. Right? All we can do is that. The answer is to be found in the writings of the person I cited in my opening remarks, the revolutionary and philosopher C.L.R. James. At about the time that the Freedom Riders were riding, he wrote, quote, "It is that people have lost the habit of looking at government and one another in a particular way." In short, what many of us have done, because we've been so carefully schooled in doing it, is to shorten our horizons, our imaginative and other horizons, in such a way that we think the PIC is here to stay, capitalism is here to stay, all kinds of other things are here to stay. And instead of taking the spirit of Jane Addams and her father and many, many others, including the 200,000 or more enslaved people of African descent who took up arms and fomented a general strike that kicked off the Civil War and made it successful, we shorten our horizons again and think, well, we can't get rid of it, so can't we make it a little more humane? Well, James said people have gotten out of the habit of looking at a government and each other in a particular way, and we might reasonably respond, well, gosh, why would the very people who are so horribly affected by the PIC, who have their lives shortened by their constant encounters with the prison industrial complex, or the encounters of their loved ones with the prison industrial complex, and their encounters of loved ones with surveillance and control, why would such people and all who rage against the prison industrial complex ever have had the habit of looking in a particularly good way at each other and government? And that's a reasonable question, right? Where would that habit have come from? Well, we can find an answer in W.E.B. Du Bois, the first known communist ever to have graced a U.S. postage stamp. He wrote in 1935, quote, "The experience of the Negro worker under Reconstruction, during Reconstruction, presents the researcher with the finest example of the Marxian theory of the state." Now, that's what he wrote in 1935, in that great book, Black Reconstruction in America, which everyone must read. If you haven't read it, you're not educated, all right? And he wrote it trying to figure out how the revolution, which was at the center of the Civil War, so the North is fighting the South, and capitalism is fighting slavery mode of production, but they're actually both capitalists and just had different ideas of hierarchy and inequality, fight, 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 and in the midst of this huge crisis, boom, up pops a revolution, right? The revolution of formerly enslaved people of African descent and their allies, John Brown, their allies. They make a revolution, and then they carry it out for as long as they can. This is what Du Bois studied to shreds, and this is what we can bring to our abolitionist thinking today, that in an earlier iteration, an earlier moment, an earlier time, of abolitionist activity in which life and death hung in the balance. That's what people did. If they did it, we can do it. Many, most notably these days, Michelle Alexander, say, we need to build a movement. Yes, and the building actually isn't from scratch. That's the good news. There are already existing pieces in motion. So let's think for a moment about what's been happening in North Africa and West Asia over the last 9, 10, 11 months. What's called, shorthand in the U.S. press, Arab Spring. That would be Arab winter, spring, summer, and fall. Now, many commentators, especially in the English-speaking world, wish to credit social media with the explosion of liberation movement in those regions, right? That somehow it's cell phones and Facebook made the revolution. Not buying it, huh? All right, that's good. Now, many people, Vijay Prashad, Paul Amar, many others, have shown organizations were the basis for that amazing social movement. So the point is not that there was nothing spontaneous occurring. Of course there was. But the spontaneity was also met with preparation. Yeah? Right? Opportunity. Preparation, opportunity. That's the definition of luck. It's also the definition of revolution. All right. So organizations used many infrastructural capacities, including cell phones and Facebook, right? But that's not where the organizing came from, to do what they did. Or, as Miles Horton and Paulo Freire underscored in their indispensable book, which carries the title from Antonio Machado's parable, We Make the Path by Walking, organizations, there and here, then and now, are the basis of social movement. And one thing that Chicago has in abundance is organizations. It was really great this noon, meeting with so many people. The prison industrial complex is an infrastructural project of daunting complexity. People, uniformed and civilian, ideas, intellectuals, places, boosters, institutions, government agencies, agitators, histories, futures, accumulations of premature death. All of that is the prison industrial complex. The prison industrial complex, like the military industrial complex before it, makes a way. It cuts a path through the landscape into which, like a canal in a flood surge, all and everything are swept. What makes the PIC what it is this fact, its dynamic and direction, rather than whether it's a big part of the national economy, and in spite of the fact that all prisons and jails are publicly funded and 95% of them are publicly managed. Everybody write that down? Right? So, while there are private prison interests that promote certain heinous legislation, like the Arizona SB 1070 and so forth, that are trying constantly to get ICE, Immigration, Customs, and Enforcement, to do more arrest and detention, there are private interests and firms doing that. Most of this is public, right? Publicly owned and operated, including many of the so-called private detention centers. They're owned by counties and cities. Right? Economically strapped places thinking, well, maybe we can sell some space to the U.S. Marshals. And they get the money from finance capitalists to build a jail that they're hoping to rent, instead of taking the money from the same finance capitalists to build a school that they could fill. This building. Newt Gingrich taught the current Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, John Boehner, to recite the following. Wow. You favor a political revolution. You want to replace the welfare state with the opportunity society. You favor workfare over welfare. You want to lock up prisoners, and you're actually prepared to give up some political pork barrel to build as many prisons as you need. Close quote. Now, when I say taught to recite, I mean that quite literally. This was part of the sort of founding documents of the contract for, or as we used to say, contract on America, when Gingrich and company rose to power in the early 1990s. And the fundamental doctrinal pieces, right, the pieces that are the same as a catechism or as the words you recite to join a club or a society, all of these guys learned to recite this. They all learned to recite it. This is what they grooved into their minds. And so we have to put this in our minds and think what we have to groove in to fight against that. And it's not just the Republicans. For Gingrich and Boehner, for many on both sides of the aisle, opportunity only means capitalism, and welfare in prison mean black people and other poor people. Since capitalism grows, allegedly sufficiently to lift all ships, what's the beef? The beef appears to be capitalism's distribution scheme. Capitalism requires inequality, and racism enshrines it. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is move the pictures a little bit and talk about the sort of fundamental pieces of the PIC, and then we'll turn a corner and talk about a lot of really exciting organizing that's gone on over the last decade or more to give you all some ideas of what it is that people are doing, and that I think a lot of you who are doing things can see from the examples that I use that what you're doing is already abolition or abolition friendly or abolition curious that will become abolition friendly. Become abolition out. Okay. So, all right, so here we go. So, what are prisons made of? And you all know this picture, this one, right? I'm not going to talk about it. I just thought it was appropriate for today. All right, prisons are made of four fundamental factors. They're made of land. They're made of labor. They're made of finance capital, money, and they're made of the state's ability to organize those factors, land, labor, money, into prison after prison after prison. So already, as I have broken down for you what prisons are made of, you could say, oh, well, that's so straightforward. Surely the factors that went into making mass incarceration so fundamental to the organization of the United States and so egregious in the world that now one in four people locked up on the planet is locked up here. Right? One in 100 adults in the U.S. is locked up, so on and so on. You know all the statistics. All right. So we have these factors of production. Labor, land, labor, money, finance capital, really. That's finance capital. And the state's capacity to organize these things. Now, in an earlier time of crisis, during the Great Depression of the 1930s, when all kinds of people were out of work, when the official unemployment rate was nearly 50%, and in certain sectors, economic sectors, it was as high as 70 or 80%, and certainly for certain people, certain age groups, it was as high as effectively 100%. People couldn't find jobs anywhere. In the midst of that crisis of the Great Depression, people went on strike, which might seem a little counterintuitive. If the guys with the money are saying we don't have any money, why would anybody strike thinking they could get the money? But they did go on strike. And the combination of strikes and other concerted actions throughout the United States, urban and rural, combined with the fact that there were external threats to the United States that the United States had not yet figured out what to do about, most notably two among many enormous revolutions, that weighed heavily on the U.S. political and economic imagination. On the one hand, the Soviet Revolution, and on the other hand, the Mexican Revolution, just down the road. During the Depression, those factors of production, which might have been transformed into prison after prison after prison, were transformed into what became the rudiments of the welfare state: Social Security, unemployment compensation, work study. We could go on and on and on. The right for certain kinds of workers to organize. However, those protections and opportunities that were codified in law and expanded during the Great Depression did not include everybody. So where men received automatically what women had to apply for individually, and while kind of expected white and generally male urban industrial workers received protections and opportunities that workers generally not white, and even if white, not male, who worked in government, in domestic service, and in agriculture were excluded from, right? With all of that, the infrastructure of workers' rights and workers' capacity to organize was laid across the entire United States landscape, and people used that infrastructure to try to bust into better situations for themselves and their families. This was the famous demonstration in Memphis, Tennessee, 4 days before Martin Luther King was assassinated. The people who were marching there were sanitation workers. They were public sector workers and therefore had marginally legal capacity to organize. They were also mostly black people, as you can see. And interestingly enough, in this picture, the one person who's not wearing the sign that says, "I am a man," is a white man. And it interests me so much that they didn't think about the rhetorics of the pictures that might be taken and compel him to wear a sign too. Do you understand? That this picture, which is insisting on equality, actually deepens imaginatively inequality. It's nobody's fault, but it's the kind of mistake that we can see in retrospect and try to figure out how to do better in the future. Not only were urban low-wage workers trying to organize so they could secure good wages for themselves and their families, but also agricultural workers were organizing, again, without sanctions from the state, to create unions for people who worked in fields. And this picture, which is for educational use only, as you can see at the top of the slide, has right at the center Cesar Chavez in the jacket, and then Dolores Huerta in the hat. I've had the opportunity to do a number of events with Dolores, who's really amazing. Okay. Now, I'm going to fast forward here because we don't have all night and there are a lot of other things I want to talk about. But it is true that while on the one hand, during the civil rights movement, there was a radical wing and a reformist wing, and the radical wing had actually in its crosshairs the whole problem of capitalism and that form of inequality that, as I said earlier, racism enshrines. And the reform wing had in its crosshairs opportunity to be as unequal within the group as the group was within the society. Right? It's kind of a cruel way to say it. But the tactics were not necessarily always leading one way or the other, and there were many times when movement, radical and reform movement people came together and fought together. And in so doing, very often radical movement people pulled to the left. Wait, which way is your left? That way. Pulled to the left. Right, pulled into more radical sphere the kind of work that people had been doing. An anti-racist, anti-sexist, anti-war, pro-healthcare, and other realms of activity. And most importantly, they joined them up. They joined things together in ways that scared the bejesus out of the ruling class and the ruling elites and the historical bloc that was kind of convinced after the passage of, the decision of Brown versus the Board of Education in 1955, that everything was going to be a little bumpy but kind of smooth from here on out. Now, by the late 1960s, several things were going on that contributed, as it were, politically and ideologically to a certain kind of backlash. So, contrary to what certain people have done in making the arguments about 60s radical and revolutionary work that was carried on in the United States, I hardly say because the 60s lefties were so radical, the only way to deal with them was to build prison after prison after prison, and therefore it's their fault. Rather, what happened was, following that exact line from 1960, when Ross Barnett, the governor of Mississippi, said, don't worry, we can use the law to squelch this stuff, that kind of practice rose and became generalized. Right? It rose and became generalized. And people were hounded, imprisoned, criminalized, killed, and sent into exile. And there are people in this room who have for years now, decades now, been working on behalf of political prisoners in the United States, of whom there are many. In addition, the United States lost a war. So not only was there revolutionary activity happening all over the United States in the 60s and even into the early 70s, even after the complete obliteration, or pretty complete obliteration, of the Black Panther Party for self-defense, the United States was going through crisis after crisis after crisis, one of which was losing the war in Vietnam, being built by a small but very determined army that wasn't going to give up until they won. And also, the United States slipped, or in my view, was pushed into a very, very long economic depression domestically, here at home, not only because of the huge costs of the war, but also because big capitalists and their puppets wanted to figure out a way to smash the worker organizing that had effectively raised wages and benefits for large numbers of workers in the United States, whether or not they belong to unions. How to get rid of it. So the U.S. going off the gold standard allowed an enormous inflation to take place in the 70s. There was high unemployment and enormous inflation and no change in wages. In fact, wages have stayed effectively flat from 1973 until now, with a few little blips, from 1973 until now. So smashing labor unions, which had become more and more and more peopled by people of color and white women, became essential to the project of capitalists to regain the really high rate of profits they'd enjoyed in the wake of World War II when they didn't have much competition. Japan was rebuilding, Germany was rebuilding, Soviet Union was doing its own thing, China was completely isolated from the rest of the world doing its own thing, and so forth. I've already talked about the rate of profit, and I'm going to move forward. So, I love this picture of the capitalists playing cards. When they're not making decisions that affect all of our lives, they like to sit around and relax. Don't we all? And what they forget is, we're always there. Listening and watching. Understanding and reporting. And planning. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit so I can talk about some projects. Some of the many uses of the fundamental factors of production for prison, land, labor, and money, in earlier periods turned into such things as public housing. This is housing that was built for GIs coming back from World War II. Housing like this was built all over the United States in cold climates as well as warm. It doesn't look all that warm, but there was housing like this right outside, right on the edge of New Haven. It was called McConaughey Terrace, and my godparents lived in a little tiny house. It was probably, I'd say, 550 square feet. They lived there. They raised their kids there. My uncle was a union guy who worked as a welder. Right? This public housing made possible for my godparents the ability to let their children go to college. And other struggles made possible free schools for those children. Yeah? So some of the factors of production that go into prisons went into free or so low cost as good as free public education all the way through PhD on the one hand, and housing, health care, other protections from calamity and opportunities for advancement that made things possible. It made it so that this kid could go to college. Now, housing, public housing, is not what it used to be. It's become in short supply, and it actually has become sort of objectively blamed for many of the ills that have occurred because of the organized abandonment of the people who live in the housing rather than the fact of the building itself. So you all recognize this place? Yeah, I thought you would. The dismantling of Cabrini Green, heralded by many people who had lived there and many people who had never lived there as a good thing because of how bad it had gotten, right? How bad it had gotten inside, was also an indication of the kind of final nail in the coffin of the organized abandonment of poor people in Chicago. That tearing this building down didn't signal, from an abolitionist perspective, that something new was going to go up. It just meant, all right, along with all the other abandonment that's come through, that's washed through communities and left them destitute and devastated, this housing will go as well. Right? So it's a different story from the story even of 1973 in St. Louis, when they blew up the Pruitt-Igoe housing. Right? Ivory Perry, who was an amazing organizer in St. Louis, was part of the organizational ability that compelled the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development to just get rid of that place. But what they had planned was the construction of new housing. Okay. So let's go to some projects. So here we have objectively, you know, this huge set of resources that have been kind of frozen into not only the buildings, the physical plant of the prison industrial complex, but all of the workers and work that it takes to keep that in operation. Yeah, all of it. So the police and the school police and all the surveillance instruments and courts and stenographers and locksmiths and mechanics and so on and so forth, right? It's really quite huge. I think Michelle Alexander says there are a million people who depend for their living on the prison industrial complex. Right? This is true. Most of those people, everyone but the guards, has a skill that can be used doing something else. A teacher can teach, a locksmith can locksmith, a mechanic can mechanic, a sweeper can sweep. So only the prison guards who are kind of locked by their specialization into one job, and everybody can learn, so they could get new jobs. All right. So it's about a million people. So now we're going to talk about some aspects of what I've come to call the popular front against the prison industrial complex. So at lunch I met with dozens of organizations here in Chicago who are doing work, and the resonances between their work and work that is happening all around the country and indeed internationally is remarkable to me. The last time I was in a room, or a recent time that I was in a room with so many different organizations doing so much work against the prison industrial complex, I was in London. And folks came from all over the UK for a strategy session, a kind of an all-day meeting with me and my partner, Craig Gilmore of the Prison Moratorium Project. And it just blew my mind to see how much work is already going on and how much of it has kind of as at its core these abolitionist principles, again, whether or not people say, I am an abolitionist or our project is abolition, that I was extremely heartened. And in my view, the best work that I can do these days is to essentially be a vector and carry around, you know, the consciousness and the activity, the campaigns and the focuses of people in all of these different places, so we have a greater and greater sense of ourselves as the popular front against the PIC. That, along with the ways of people, for example, here in Chicago today at Hull House, talks about how they can, you know, connect their work more closely and collaborate without giving up the projects that they have committed themselves to. And that's always a hard thing for activists. Somebody comes and says, do this other thing. You go, I'm already doing this thing for 85 hours a week. Where do I get the other hour? So here I'm going to talk through slides for a few minutes. Let me go back to this guy. All right. So one of the things that we've done in many, many communities throughout the United States and also abroad is to ask people to come together in a room. There's a few seats down here if people are getting tired of standing. To ask people to come together in a room and get up and take a couple or 3 minutes and say what they are doing to make their community better. Right? And they can say whatever it is they do. So we don't ask people to get up and also denounce the prison industrial complex. We take the denunciation for granted, and we ask people to say what they're doing, what their remedies are. Not remedies necessarily focused on PIC, on incarcerated people and so forth, but what do they do? What are they doing in their communities? And we call these gatherings usually town halls or something like that, and have some folks sitting in the front of the room, so there's clearly somebody listening who's going to interact with folks, and we do kind of snowball outreach to get as many different kinds of people as possible to come and speak. So this kid is a first-generation college student at Cal State LA, California State University at Los Angeles. First generation, grew up in East Los Angeles, son of Mexican immigrants, who talked about how he and his friends had started an organization to work with young people who were like themselves and who might get on the wrong path and wind up in prison instead of in school. That's really great, and we were excited to hear about it and to figure out what kinds of projects he could do with the kids he worked with to further his goals. Now, college students working with young people at risk is, of course, not a new thing. And this is a picture of a college student who, back in the 1960s, was working with young people at risk who might be caught up in actually just being killed by the police or run over by a car. So that's Huey Newton, student, and the kids he was working with out of the first Black Panther Party office. And I used to live a block from that office in Dover Street, and there was a speed bump in front of my house, and I found out that speed bump wasn't just a speed bump. It was a legacy of the Black Panther Party. They put these speed bumps on Dover Street to stop the slaughter of kids playing in the street by people using Dover Street to avoid the more trafficked big street. It used to be called Grove Street. Now I think it's called Martin Luther King Boulevard that runs through Oakland there. One of the reasons, of course, that public education has been so threatened with total abandonment and has been so deeply abandoned is this. It is not surprising that an advisor to both Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan said, when Reagan was the governor of California, those words, "We're in danger of producing an educated proletariat," and that's dynamite. UIC is dynamite, which is fantastic. The two people on the right of the screen, John Huggins above, who's my cousin, and Bunchy Carter below, were members of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. As you know, they were students. They were students at UCLA. They were organizing students at UCLA. They were also really central in the Black Panther Party office, so it wasn't as though because they were students they weren't also Black Panther Party revolutionaries, or because they were Black Panther Party members they weren't seriously students. They were both. They were both. So, you know, one of the divides that a lot of people get really kind of messed up about, oh, if I'm a student, I'm not that, or if I'm this, I'm not that, is a false distinction that we would do well to undo. In fact, the entire social division of political labor is something that we should put our minds to remedy. This slide, which is a data slide, but don't worry about it, just look at the shape of the curves. This slide basically shows, kind of proves, that who has paid for the increase in prisons in California, and I would say anywhere else where prisons have expanded and schools gotten more expensive, have been the students, right? That the increase in the number of people in prison and the increase in the cost of education have gone up at just about the same curve. And students are borrowing more and more money, and they're paying more and more for education, and that is the money that's been taken out of education in order to pay for prisons. All right. So we get down to the ground, and we see that people are speaking out and acting out in every way that they possibly can. And on the other hand, they were trying to figure out how to outreach to the kids who are having a hard time coming back to figure out how they could help each other. And what they did was not merely set up a center, which they did do, Youth Justice Center, for kids coming out of prison who would have a place to go where they could hang out, do whatever they wanted to. It was not on anybody's gang turf. Anybody could come. Colors, not an issue. It became instantly known as neutral turf and respected as such. So people could come and start learning about what had happened to them. These kids had me come in to give several talks and workshops, and other people come in to give several talks and workshops. They read books like Black Reconstruction in America. These are kids who dropped out of junior high school, right? They read this stuff because they want to know. And once they figured out what was going on and began to understand and develop their own analysis of why it was that their abandonment was so crucial to the United States, they decided that they were ready to fight, and one of the things they did in order to fight was to start their own school. So these folks, they kind of stand in for the school here, started a school for kids coming out of prison who had all dropped out of whatever level. And because Noy, on the right, had not graduated from high school himself, he was for a while running a school, and then he had to go to night school. So by day, he was the head of a school, and by night, he was in night school getting his GED so he could go back and run his day school. So here we have a negation in which the young people at Youth Justice Coalition, which also has another name, Chuchu's Justice Center, have created this astonishing capacity to educate themselves and educate other people, and they bring folks in all the time. They fight for certain kinds of legislative changes. They do direct action. Whatever can be done, they do. And they're very aware and wary of how vulnerable they are because so many of them have felonies. The fact is they could all get struck out, right? So what they've done hasn't ended their nightmare, but it's the only way they could imagine bringing an end to the nightmare. In addition, many people in rural communities have stepped up in the fight against the actual building of prisons themselves. And while in the earliest years of anti-prison activism in rural communities, a good deal of the work was organized around not in my backyard, we don't want those people here, blah, 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 over time, because of the outreach that people have done all over the country to rural communities, folks in rural communities have changed, not all of them, but many of them have changed their analysis because they learned from me and some of my colleagues that the dough they think they're going to get from this prison is not going to wind up in their pockets. So that is enough to make them slow down and listen to other things and begin to learn how it is that the abandonment of young people, of adults, criminalization of so many people, including immigrants, mostly, although not exclusively, in urban areas, has produced this mushrooming effect of prisons in rural areas. And what they want in rural areas, of course, are jobs that are good, and they want environmentally safe communities where their kids can grow up without suffering from asthma and other harms that are produced by environmental toxins. And so what they've done in the Central California Environmental Justice Network, in some rural justice work that I've had the honor to participate in the U.S. Southeast, in upstate New York, and elsewhere, has been to join forces with prison abolitionists, with anti-prison people, in order to realize a program of economic development and environmental justice. So this too has happened. And this picture actually is international. The woman on the left is from Ensenada, Baja California, Mexico, Mexico. And she came to a meeting that we had out in the desert in Southern California in order to learn about work that communities had been doing against a new sort of high-speed rail and very intensive roadway that had been built in Southern California that produced so much diesel exhaust that every child, not one in four children, but effectively every child within about a 1,500-meter margin of that roadway was suffering from asthma or very asthma-like conditions. And since in Ensenada there was a plan to build a similar kind of roadway, she came to learn about the roadway. But in sitting in this environmental justice meeting in which we talked also about policing in prisons, she recognized that Mexico was beginning to adopt some of the policing and legal strategies used in the United States that's led to mass incarceration. So she went home, still an environmental justice advocate, but somebody who also was carrying a message across an international border about what's going on here and to look for signs of it happening there. And one last example, and then I will conclude. Many of the, Los Angeles is still one of the manufacturing capitals of the United States. Cook County is the other number one. They go back and forth. Cook County, L.A., Cook County, L.A. One or the other is the number one manufacturing capital of the United States, which is to say people have jobs making things, right? The jobs, however, are not the old high-wage jobs, right, working in heavy industry, steel, and so forth. They're low-wage jobs, high-value-added jobs, such as apparel manufacturer. And these jobs are very difficult for unions to organize because the number of firms employing the people is numerous. The firms change overnight. They're the same people, but they're a different company. So actually waging an organizing campaign against one of them, as is also the case for many janitorial workers and other workers, is extremely difficult because there isn't a target, right? There isn't a target called a business. However, sewing machine operators and grocery store clerks, who are also heavily come from immigrant communities, took it upon themselves to organize this demonstration and project to demand fair wages, to demand that they be paid all their wages, because wage theft is very common, especially from immigrant workers, people without documents. Right, the assumption is such people will never complain. So wage theft is really, really high in those communities. So these folks got together to fight against wage theft, but by coming out into public and saying effectively, my wages have been stolen, so you might conclude I'm not documented, so you might think that you want to round us up, but there's so many of us it would be hard to do. They took a step toward the sort of abolitionist agenda of using something other than fear to organize how we think about and do the political work of raising consciousness and achieving our goals. So the last thing to say is that what's happening here and around the country is that rooms like this one and rooms like this one, sparsely filled but filled with all different kinds of people there, are coming together, and folks are talking from a number of different kinds of organizations, positions, vantage points about how it is they want to make their community different. And they're not talking anymore in the language of public safety, because the language of public safety is continually corrupted. So while we are interested in safety, we're interested in safety in the form of security, and security in the form of knowing that we have the not only the basics for everyday life, but also the ability to have pleasure and beauty. We have many artists in this room tonight, and art is not an embellishment of life, it is fundamental to life. And when we ask people at these meetings, at these town halls, in these various convenings, what it is they would spend money on if they had $1 billion to spend, and we give them money, you know, the U.S. prints money, we print money. Give everybody money and say to spend it, you see what they spend it on. And we all always put police up on the wall. Full disclosure. And a few people spend some money on police, but never very many. And so our goal here and there and everywhere is to go from this to this over and over and over and over again. So in conclusion, critical resistance came into being at a historical moment when the growth of mass incarceration, which was already breathtaking, was so industrialized, so moving like an efficient machine, making more and more prisoners, that it was devastating more communities and entailing more obligations for more and more people who get paid because of the PIC. We wanted to stop it, and as the title of this talk and the subtitle of our conference proclaimed, get beyond it. The first CR conference, which at the time was only ever going to be a conference, happened in September of 1998, 13 years ago this week, 2 months after the Black Radical Congress here at UIC drew thousands of people from around the country and around the world to reignite the Black Radical tradition. I believe the convergence of these eruptions of energy is present in what we're trying to accomplish tonight. I don't believe the U.S. prison system is broken. I believe it works the way it is supposed to work. By exposing to premature death modestly educated women and men in the prime of their lives who, had they employment or income guarantees, would make their livings making, moving, growing, and caring for things. The U.S. is addicted to prisons. And as every addict and alcoholic knows, I'm Ruthie, I'm an alcoholic, to recover from addiction, you only have to change one thing, everything. Or, to put my thoughts in loftier terms, I'll borrow one last time from Martin Luther King Jr., who said on April the 4th, 1967, "I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered." Thank you.
Just to dance away restriction. Gonna be cruising up and down, hang up alleyway. You're my only guy. We shall all be moving.
Don't fail me now.
Giving you more of what we're fighting for.
Yeah.